I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Republicans are the party of freedom. Democrats are the party of socialism and worse. That's what's happened. The Democrat Party is a whole different deal.
That's the president there summing it up for you. And I got to say, I was going to start this whole show off today talking about Charles Barkley, but Brian Kilmeade did it again. And he talked about Charles Barkley last in his show. And since he's Brian Kilmeade, I will just bow out of the Charles Barkley thing for now, but I will be talking about Charles Barkley in a little bit. But listening to something that Burgess Owens just said on the Brian Kilmeade show, this is what Burgess Owens just said. Everything Dems are doing is about hopelessness. And that kind of made me stop what I was doing, lining stories up to talk to you about today here on the Annie Fry Show. And it made me think, I think that sums it up. I think that sums up the whole shebang. Everything that you are seeing right now, everything you're consuming, that weight that you have on your shoulders, even on a good day, it's a good day because you managed to, you know, blind yourself to the realities that are around you. And chances are, if you're anything like me, you can distract yourself for only so long until you realize, okay, how do I need to prepare for the next shoe to drop? We are surrounded right now. The reason why this world that we're living in on July 13th here in the middle of 2020 feels so heavy is because we are being reminded of our ever-living hopelessness. And it is a sad thing. The virus, massive, heavy weight for people to bear. And you are made to feel hopeless. I know a lot of people think that the idea of wearing masks is, you know, making you subservient to the government. I think that the idea of wearing a mask because you choose to, I choose to wear a mask when I go places because I have chosen to do it, not because, you know, Lord Pritzker has told me to, like, check the record on that. It's because I'm choosing to. I've talked about the mask wearing thing regarding going to church. There are people who are in church with me who would not feel comfortable and not feel safe being in church if people were sitting in there not wearing a mask. So why in the world would I not wear a mask to make those people feel comfortable in church? So that's kind of been my foundation on it. But it's my choice. It's my decision. And that's what I've chosen to do, which is me, you know, flexing on my freedom as much as anybody who's choosing to do differently because it's my choice. The idea of a scary virus that's out there, and folks, it is a scary virus, but the good thing about it is we know who it's the most scary for now. In the beginning of all of this, we had no idea who it was going to impact the most. We had no idea who was going to be majorly susceptible to this, how it was transferred from one place to the other. You know, like I remember I would get my email or my email. I would get my actual mail from my mailbox maybe once a week. And I would, because I'm too lazy, I didn't get gloves on. I just pull my sleeves down on my shirt and like scoop the mail out of the mailbox. And then I would go sit it in on the deep freeze in our freezer for a few days. And then I would go back and get it later. I'm not doing that now. I'm also not as scared now because I know who is at risk and who is not as at risk. And that's not to say that there are people who are more at risk in getting it. It's what happens when you do get it. I know that it is my responsibility to protect my 95-year-old grandmother, and it's my responsibility to protect my dear friends who have immunocompromised children. It's my job to do that. It is my civic responsibility to make sure that we protect them. I also know that if we are going to continue to address this coronavirus situation as the Democrats would have you address it, which is shut everything down, that a broken economy is going to hurt the well and the sick, both of them together. So there has to be something in the middle. And we have to be able to choose what we're going to do by ourselves. So when Burgess Owens says that everything the Dems are doing right now is about hopelessness, I understand that. You know why it's about hopelessness? Because we can, as Democrats and Republicans, almost always, I know, hold on to your butts here, agree on something. It's what the problem is. We always agree politically what the issue is. Let's take people being murdered in inner cities. That has to stop. You don't need to be a Democrat or Republican to acknowledge the fact that the danger that exists in poverty-stricken areas, that something needs to be done about it, that we need to be paying attention to it. Some might direct the question as to why are these places impoverished? What is being done to get them out of poverty? And then other people say guns should go away. And then they do a large sweep over everybody and say guns need to go away from everywhere. When you hear Burgess Owens say everything Dems are doing is about hopelessness, you need to understand that the Democratic solution to every problem and worry that you have is more government. And you need to understand that every governmental solution that is going to be provided is going to come from a Democrat, because Republicans are out there saying the government needs to get out of the way most of the times. Most of the time, what you are going to hear from a Republican, a real honest Republican candidate, is that the people, is that you are the responsibility. You are what is great about this country, and you are what needs to come to the table to make whatever the problem is go away. And the government either needs to A, get out of your way to make it happen, or B, help you in a capacity to help yourself, which is why we have seen some of the unemployment benefits coming out of bipartisan groups of people, because we're in a situation that is so large and so massive that there is some help that is needed to be provided from where? Your tax dollars. This is not Nancy Pelosi's checkbook that she's opening up. This is not Chuck Schumer's credit card that he's handing you. It's your money, folks. And you only pay taxes when you make money. Hopelessness. Democrats sell hopelessness to you in an effort that when you buy it, you will use it in a capacity where you cash it in for more Democratic control. It is a cycle, and it is very, very intentional. It is very frustrating to see the constant peddling of victim creating and victim blaming. And, you know, what we see with the race concern that we have right now, we have racial tensions in this country. We've always had racial tensions. That's not something that's new, but good grief, we've gotten a lot better at them, haven't we? Haven't we grown quite a bit as a country? I think we have. But we're going back and we're relitigating what the people who were fighting in the Civil War would pray that someday we would be at the point where we are right now, where men and women, white people and all non-white people, would actually be looked at as equal. When I am looking at my Twitter feed, and I am seeing NBA players who are going to play a season in, I don't know, over the course of like 6 or 8 weeks or something like that at Disney, they are being put up in accommodations that families would kill to have and never be able to afford. And they're posting pictures. I don't know who the athlete was, but one of them was saying something about comparing himself to a Ferrari. And saying, like, when you hire a Ferrari, you got to feed the Ferrari like it's a Ferrari, not like it's a Chrysler. Well, excuse me, in my Chrysler Pacifica, my thing is just fine. And I would love to be staying in that room that you're in. If you want to see, like, here you have African-American athletes staying in ridiculously nice accommodations at Disney World that the rest of, you know, America would adore the opportunity to stay there. You have African-American NBA players talking about how they're a Ferrari and looking down their nose at staying at the Coronado at Disney World. And I guess in the next segment, we talk about oppression and how they are not looked at the same as white people. I mean, you cannot have it both ways. You cannot have the NBA having Black Lives Matter across the back of their jerseys and talking about oppression when their oppression is that they have to stay at a deluxe level resort at Disney World so they can make their millions of dollars. Give me a break. Like, it's over. It's done. You're out of touch. If we are going to have to listen to these kinds of messages from these people who are of very, very high society, it really loses the sting of what we're actually talking about and what actually does exist. And we need to understand that and call that out. We need to be willing to say, you know, if, like I've said a million times on the show now, Black Lives Matter, it's a sentence. Of course they do. But if you're going to bait and switch words that mean something with an agenda that I have to listen to some NBA player shove down my throat while they're complaining about their oppressive conditions at Disney World, it's like the Twilight Zone's Twilight Zone. We are warped through Twilight Zones now, and I can't even recognize the world we're living in. We are supposed to be made to feel hopeless because the only hope that the Democratic Party wants to give is bigger and more government. The religion of the Democratic Party is government. They want you to put your hope and your faith in their government. And if you don't do it, you are evil. You are for what is terrible. You are whatever ist that they want to throw at you. A racist, a misogynist, a sexist. Those are scary things. So instead, you just keep your mouth shut and you don't speak up. We can work together for a better tomorrow. We can work to continue to eradicate sexism and racism that exist in our country right now because they still do exist. And I promise you, in 100 years, there's going to be a version of it that exists in 100 years from now. It's not going to go away, but it's our responsibility to make sure that we continue to work on it every day. We are a broken people. We need to constantly, constantly work to be better and be just massively generous with forgiveness. Massively generous with forgiveness. That is the missing piece of the entire puzzle. Let's take a quick break because when we come back, Dr. Scott Hardiman is going to join us. He's a physician at Gateway ENT and also urgent specialist, and he has some coronavirus updates to give us. And I am looking forward to taking your questions. Ryan and I are going to be watching the questions on the Facebook Live and on the YouTube Live. So any coronavirus questions that you have, whether it's about statistics, if it's about mask wearing, whatever you want to ask, comment them on the Facebook Live at facebook.com/Annie Fry Show or the YouTube Live. Just type in Annie Fry, F-R-E-Y, into YouTube, subscribe to the channel, and watch us there. We'll be right back.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
We do not slow the spread of COVID-19. With that rise of hospitalizations that you're seeing in Lubbock, with the increased death rate we're seeing in the state of Texas, the next step would have to be a lockdown. The last thing I want to do, the last thing anybody in Texas wants to do, is to see another lockdown. Hence, the best thing everybody can do is do this thing that is inconvenient of wearing a face covering, knowing that it will keep your jobs open, your economy open, and your businesses open.
So that's the governor of Texas, Governor Abbott, talking about the potential of another shutdown in Texas, because Texas is one of those places that we are seeing cases rising once again. Each Monday, we have Dr. Scott Hardiman on with us. He's a physician at Gateway ENT, also at Urgent Specialists. Go to urgentspecialist.com and learn about this really, really great urgent care in the area near you. And we're asking questions of Dr. Scott Hardiman that you have. So you can comment them on our Facebook Live. You can comment them on our YouTube Live. If you have any questions that you want to ask, go ahead and comment them. We'll add them in right here. Doctor, thank you for coming on with us again. Great to have you back.
Thanks so much. Happy Monday.
Thank you. You as well. So we see surges in places like Texas, Florida. I think Arizona is one of them. I haven't heard the word surge necessarily associated with Missouri or Illinois. How do you feel about those locations that are seeing the surge, and how do Missouri and Illinois compare in your understanding?
Well, I think the places you mentioned, Texas, Arizona, to some degree California, Florida, of course, where the media and the focus has largely been over the past couple of weeks or so, they really didn't have that, quote, surge back in April, May timeframe, like we saw in New York, or really even to some degree in the St. Louis area where we saw our numbers sort of reach that peak. So they're climbing towards that now. Places in Missouri and Illinois, we've been really pretty steady. We've had, obviously, it's in the news a lot. We've had an increase in numbers of cases, but hospitalizations have sort of held steady, kind of up, down from day to day. So we really haven't had that big spike, although there's been quite an uptick in just the number of positive cases as well. Fortunately, they've been less severe and not requiring as hospitalizations like they were before. So I think what we're just seeing is in certain places, we're starting to see them just hit their stride, their peak, like we had a while back.
Dr. Hardiman, in your professional opinion, since we're talking about localized surges around the country, United States is a big place. It seems like we had this big, big hit with New York, and the rest of the country kind of responded in March all the same way. Do you think that it would have been wiser if we had said, okay, well, that's happening in New York, we'll wait until it happens here for us to sort of respond and shut things down instead of doing it as a blanket move?
That's a really great question. We knew so little about this in the big picture of things. I think from a modeling perspective, most of the country shutdown was based upon some epidemiologic models. As it's turned out, the vast majority of cases really fall in certain states and certain counties really across the country. And so I think it was an exercise to get prepared, not really sure what was coming. In hindsight, a more targeted approach would probably have been prudent. But it's awfully difficult to criticize when you see something new like this happen to know for certain how will it actually play out. Certainly now, I think with the testing capacity we have, and see, for instance, New York is really in very good shape, and their daily data is just fantastic compared to where they were before. Not that it's gone from existence there, but certainly much better. And in places that had a pretty good surge before, obviously those numbers have continued to decline. So if we have to go that route, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of appetite, certainly among me or a lot of other people in the country, that would really tolerate a complete shutdown again. But certainly a targeted approach to therapy with more testing and trying to isolate little pockets here or there. And just to emphasize to people that a little bit of personal responsibility, that as you see cases bump up and testing get done and certain age groups of people testing positive, you know, do the right thing, isolate. A lot of people don't have symptoms. It's hard. I mean, it's mentally kind of a difficult thing to say. I tested positive. I feel 100% normal. Or I just had the sniffles, to isolate yourself out and to try and slow the transmission a bit. But that's the type of behavior that if people can do that, it will really slow down transmission and we'll see those numbers drop back off again.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman, a physician who comes to us every Monday and discusses the coronavirus as we continue to push through it. I want to talk a little bit about the process of who needs to get tests, or how do you, you've mentioned there that there are a lot of people who are asymptomatic. If you were to contract the flu, something that we all understand a little bit more than coronavirus, unless you catch it in time, is my understanding, like you can go in and get Tamiflu. But other than that, you hydrate, you stay at home, you maybe take some ibuprofen if you need to, but you stay at home and you get better. And unless there are, you know, certain things that happen that make you need to go get extra care from a hospital. Mm-hmm. Is this the way it is largely for coronavirus patients where, I mean, you can get a test, but a test doesn't help you. It just tells you what you have. Like, who needs to go get tested? Who, if they feel uncomfortable, needs to just stay at home and keep to themselves and until they can get better? Like, what's your advice to those individuals who think, I might be feeling a little something?
Let me answer that maybe two ways. Let me talk about the testing part first. So one of the tricky parts about this particular illness is that it has a little longer, we'll call it incubation period for lack of a better description, from time of a significant exposure to the time that you would either A, test positive, or B, manifest symptoms. So 3 to 5, sometimes 7 days or so. There's a lot of talk about 14-day quarantines when you've had an exposure, and that sort of works from the premise that you can develop symptoms out to 14 days, but if there's testing capacity, you can test someone 5 to 7 days into it and feel pretty confident if it's a quality test that they're going to be negative at that point, and then just closely monitor their symptoms going forward. So who needs to be tested? That's part of the issue is that right now there's a little bit of paranoia and panic out there that everyone who knows someone that had an exposure wants to be tested right then. And the tests are really, there's a lot of variability to them. They are accurate to a degree, but you have to put it in the whole clinical picture of things. So testing someone the day after they've had an exposure serves no purpose because they'll be negative that day, and 5 days later they may be positive and they get a false sense of security in there. So that's an educational issue, and physicians need to lead the charge on that and really try and help people understand what truly an exposure is. Was there source control, or was the person who has the infection wearing a mask? Were you as the individual wearing a mask? What was your distance? Was it a closed environment or not? And try and figure out who really is at risk in that situation, and then when to test and test appropriately based upon that. So certainly symptomatic people with a pretty solid known exposure at the right period of time, it warrants testing. There's a lot of asymptomatic people being tested. A lot of outpatient surgical procedures or medical procedures are being done, and by and large across the city and probably across the country, most of those patients are being screened with a COVID test prior to having their procedure done. So those are tests that they're sort of casting a net to try and pick up the ones and twos that turn up positive so that person potentially, if they're asymptomatic, doesn't expose the healthcare team and require shutdown of an ambulatory surgery center, or imaging center, or hospital, OR, et cetera. So that's sort of the environment where people are being tested. To your question about influenza, it's a great talking point because the influenza is an illness that, by and large, when you get it, you get sick. I can't remember if we talked about this last week or not, but people generally are not asymptomatic from flu. Some, of course, are more symptomatic than others. Some get very sick. Some get mild symptoms, but pretty much everyone gets sick. There's a pretty narrow window of time to treat with Tamiflu, and so if you catch that usually within the first 24 to 48 hours, maybe 72, you can use Tamiflu to try and ease those symptoms. This is an illness that it seems as if a good chunk of the individuals who contract it have minimal to no symptoms, meaning 70 to 80%. Studies go anywhere from 60% up to over 80% really have no symptoms by and large or minimal. And so that makes it a little tricky if they test positive because, again, like I said earlier, you don't really feel sick and it's hard psychologically to pull yourself back, especially after 3 or 4 months of being in a lockdown situation like that. So now you have individuals out there who you have or groups of the population, about 20 to 25% of people who are the sick individuals. And so, you know, we shut down the economy, shut down things based upon an illness that, by and large, of those that get it, 20 to 25% are the ones that get sick. And we know that the vast majority of those who end up in hospitalizations or deaths tend to be in the over 65 population as well. So you pare all that down, and for the younger population, say 50 to 60 or less, the mortality rate is exceptionally low, and the symptoms tend to be fairly minimal. They're not zero. Obviously, this is a real thing, and you have to be very careful. But we also have better treatment options out there now and things that you can do in supportive care as we understand more about this.
We're speaking with Dr. Scott Hardiman. He is a physician at Gateway ENT, also urgent specialist online at urgentspecialist.com. What about, I've heard people have a significant concern, if they go to get tested, whether they were to test positive or negative, but mostly if they were to test positive, who gets that information and what happens to it? Because I know people who are having to go get tested for their jobs because they work in healthcare facilities, but yep. I know other people who were associated with those individuals who are getting tested at a healthcare facility and thinking that maybe they wanted to go get a test, but they were worried about the possibility of A, testing positive, and B, then that information is out there. What kind of information is given to people, and where does it go?
So depending on the test location and where you go, if it's a city or state-sanctioned testing location versus private testing facilities, the degree of information that's compiled ahead of time, there is some information that's necessary. Do you have a known exposure? Do you have any symptoms? Groups of people that you were associated with? That's really about it at most places. Certainly if there's large outbreaks where there's a big group of people that kind of get tested together, that information tends to be gathered a bit. But largely it's positives and negatives that are reported to the state, and that information then is shared. There's a number of data collecting sites that do that, and it takes a few days for all that to work its way into the system. So you're kind of looking at running averages that you see. So daily reports from today are probably reflective of a little bit of gathered information over the course of the past couple of days or so. There are cases, obviously, if there's a big gathering, they talk about these, what they call it, a COVID party or something in Texas, where people said, let's just all get together and just see what happens, which is really shocking that someone would think to that level to do that. But they're going to gather that information. They're going to contact trace that, which is the whole premise of contact tracing, is trying to figure out there's large groups of people and how they can run that exercise out so that they can determine if they need to survey or keep an eye on other groups of individuals as a result of that.
So is it possible to test positive and keep it a secret, where you were to quarantine yourself for the 14 days and maybe identify if you've been staying to yourself, maybe identify the few people you might have had contact with? Is it possible to do that? Or when you go to get a test somewhere, you're going to be providing some information to people that will be out?
I think you're going to be providing some information, but there's just no capacity within the state to run down or to track an individual. I mean, that's that personal responsibility level. If you test positive and you're a mom or a dad in a family, chances are that information doesn't make it any further other than there was a positive test. I am personally only aware of one group of individuals that were contacted by someone from the state wanting more information and or trying to find out if they were associated with a large gathering. The vast majority of people get tested, it gets reported as a positive, and that's pretty much the way it ends at that
point.
Sounds
like you should go get tested if you have questions.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you have symptoms, for sure, I would not use that worry as a way to to not go get tested. And I understand where people are coming from. Obviously, there's some privacy issues and civil liberty of issues that are clearly at stake in situations like this. But mistake that for good health measure, for sure.
Dr. Hardiman, one more quick question for you here. I don't know if you know how we're doing locally as far as hospital capacity goes, but I've seen reports that different cities in the country are experiencing, they're at capacity or they're close. Is that because we've delayed all non-essential surgeries and now those are happening alongside of COVID cases?
100% correct, yeah. I mean, I think the reality is that hospitals and ICUs generally have a minimum threshold target that they look for. When hospitals function appropriately and kind of make sense for them financially, they're, 75 to 85% at capacity. So we come off the tail end of 3 months of no elective surgeries and procedure being done, not to mention the fact that people have been hiding out at home, not seeking medical care, and we ramp those things up. I'd have to really dive into situations in certain cities and counties in Texas and Florida and Arizona right now, but a good chunk, as in 70% at one point, of the ICU beds they were saying were not occupied by COVID patients. They might be nearing capacity, but a lot of that has to do with non-COVID related issues, post-surgical patients, or people with other health related issues like that. As far as St. Louis goes, we're not at capacity. I mean, it's definitely, there's the most recent updates from the task force, 150 or so people, I think, hospitalized around the city. There's some under investigation here and there. Ventilatory capacity is, we're nowhere near that at this point. So the numbers are still, despite upticks here and there and picking up more cases, is, you know, not a panic situation or even considered a surge in the metropolitan area across the state, certainly as large at this point.
All right, Dr. Scott is going to stick with us for another segment, and I see a lot of questions coming through on the Facebook live chat and on the Annie Fry YouTube live chat, so keep them coming. We will fire them off to him here in just a minute when we return. You're listening to The Annie Fry Show.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. Thank you for joining us. It is Monday, and we've got Dr. Scott Hardiman here on the line with us answering your coronavirus questions. And I've got a whole bunch of them from listeners here. Here's the first one I've got for you, Doctor. This is from Patrick on our Facebook Live. Why is it they stick a swab all the way up your nostril to get a test when a drop of saliva in the air can give you the virus? I think that's a fair question. Yeah. So tell us how that can be the case.
So the virus gains access largely through the nasal or oral cavity with some potential for contamination to the mucous membranes of the eye. It tends to hang there and replicate until the point where it moves down to the respiratory tree into the lungs, where obviously most of the damage seems to occur from this illness, at least initially on. So when you cough, of course, you're moving secretions out of those areas, or sneezing certainly too, moving secretions out of the area. Getting a sample, right now samples are largely taken from nasal cavity or the front part of your nose, and nasopharynx, which is the back part of the nose where they're sticking that swab, it feels like, to your brain. And then you can use saliva as well. So saliva has really grown in popularity recently because of a study out of Yale that talked about how the viral load was easily detectable. It's certainly a heck of a lot easier for patients to an oral swab, or producing saliva or even, you know, sputum or mucus from the back of your throat can see that as well. So any of those sources are legitimate. The theory is that if you can get enough of a sample from wherever you go, that you'll have enough viral load to be able to identify that.
Dr. Hardiman, a question from Joseph on our Facebook page. Is the spread so extensive now that there's really no mitigation or control? Is it beyond trying to control it?
No, I think, you know, still the number of, well, control is an interesting question because it's what exactly defines that? You know, we're moving down this path of hoping to have a vaccine, hoping to have some level of herd immunity. At what percentage does that herd immunity actually hit? You know, still, right now in the state of Missouri, of all the people being tested, and there's a lot of tests being done, I think to date we've tested 535,000 people or so, give or take a bit. And right now, the percentages that are positive are only around 5.5 to 5.7%. So again, some patients have symptoms, some patients don't have symptoms. So the hit rate with testing sort of shows us that really, as a big percentage of those being tested, it's still pretty low. So it's not. I mean, we certainly even haven't hit any numbers of capacity to get to 10% of our population. And there is some evidence out there, some studies that are popping up from place to place now, that perhaps the number of people who've had this and or currently have it who are asymptomatic is maybe 8 to 10 times higher than what we'd normally see. But again, the idea is to slow down the transmission of it enough that it, A, doesn't overwhelm the healthcare system, and B, that allows us to quickly identify those that are most vulnerable and try and protect them, meaning the older individuals and those with other health-related issues. Sweden, we talked about this a long time ago, Sweden took a totally different approach to this, just inching towards herd immunity. So they had a different approach where they just left society open, and they saw a pretty dramatic increase. But based upon their projections now, they made a statement that their deaths would probably peak out around 5,000 to 6,000 based upon their population, that they felt like that once about 10 to 15% of their population became positive, that it would sort of start to burn itself out. And if the data and information is coming through is correct, it seems like that's the case. I think their total, I haven't looked today, but over the weekend, I think it was around 5,500 or so fatalities associated with this, which would, and it's been pretty stable over a period of time. So that would imply that perhaps you can achieve some level of maybe not true herd immunity, but slowing the transmission naturally with less of the population becoming infected. And it would be interesting to see what happens out of New York. Obviously, there's some pretty strict shutdown methods in place still in New York, but their numbers have been very stable or decreasing substantially. And, you know, we don't really know what the exact percentage of population that's been infected there actually is at this point, just because it seems like there's less people getting sick currently. But it's not too late. I think we're going to be with this for a while. We just need to keep our heads about us and not be fearful of this, but respect the illness itself and understand who needs to be tested and how to care for those that are most vulnerable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading from Fox News right now that New York City has reported its first day in nearly 4 months without a single coronavirus death. That's something to be celebrated. Brad, on our YouTube Live, the Annie Fry YouTube page right now, says that he has a question. I heard Dr. Fauci mention that it's unlikely we will reach herd immunity. Isn't that the purpose of a vaccine, to assist in reaching herd immunity?
It is. You know, there's a lot of conflicting information about vaccines. That some studies came out last week that said that there was some very promising evidence with some of the vaccine studies initially, that the level of neutralizing antibodies that were produced by the vaccine in early phase studies were substantially high. And that makes you feel good that there is potentially options for a vaccine. It still has to be clearly tested and made sure it's safe and achieves the desired goal. But then, you know, you hear on the other side that there's evidence that perhaps the vaccine will only be about 70% effective. And, you know, we see that with influenza, and that there's some misses from year to year on the level of immunity that people achieve in the community, too. So herd immunity naturally, generally we talk about that just from an epidemiologic perspective, at about 60 to 70% of the population would need to have some level of immunity to this. But if what we're trying to really do is slow down the transmission of it to the point that we can, again, isolate people and protect and, you know, pick up case clusters here and there, you may not have to get to full herd immunity to do that. Our capacity to test and to isolate are a lot better today than they were a few months ago, when it seemed like our only real hope was to, you know, somehow achieve herd immunity either through natural selection or through through a vaccine.
Rob has a question for Dr. Hardiman. He says, I'm an elementary teacher, likely going back to work in the fall. Considering we take all necessary precautions, what are the chances a third grader would give me the virus?
This is a great topic to talk about right now, timely-wise, as schools are really desperately trying to figure out a path forward. So there is a lot of evidence now. American Academy of Pediatrics is strongly urging schools reopen, although they've walked back a little bit of that and said to exercise some caution. There's two parts to that. One, of course, is protecting the kids, and two is protecting the staff, the teachers, and everyone else that works at the school. You know, it's an important thing to kind of identify now that there hasn't been a tremendous amount of evidence yet that kids are the vectors for this, that are giving it to older individuals. In fact, I read a study last week that really talked strongly about the fact that in family clusters, that it seemed like the parents were the ones testing positive, and later on the kids tested positive. You couple that with the fact that children largely don't get overly ill with this, whether that's through some difference in their immune system early on that protects them, or from potential cross-reactivity, some other coronavirus that they're seeing, it's a different perspective altogether. So the question there, I think, would be is you got to protect the teachers as well, but it seems like that the kids are not transmitting this to the older adult population as much as what was initially thought, which is why the schools were shut down very quickly early on. So I think schools are looking for a path forward. Most that I'm affiliated with and have talked with are ones that have a plan, a contingency plan in place that they're opening, and they have good concept in place of how they're going to survey that, monitor the kids, and then can move from there to some sort of virtual learning or hybrid model if necessary. But I think that there's emerging evidence all the time, and it seems to be growing, that the kids are not necessarily the ones that are the vectors for this. And I would just couple that with the fact that really daycares have stayed open this entire time. And while we've heard of an awful lot of outbreaks in nursing homes and skilled nursing facilities, which has been incredibly lethal and very sad to see that happen, we haven't heard of any outbreaks in child care facilities like that among the staff or among the kids. And other countries around the world have been able to keep their schools open with some good measures in place and have done well with the kids.
I want to ask you a follow-up question on that, and it's because I'm going to have a lawyer coming on in the next hour who's going to be talking about the Illinois High School Sports Association's regulations for resuming athletics, school sports. They have said that they want all students to be wearing masks at all time. If you're playing basketball, if you're playing volleyball in a gym, you're going to have to do the whole thing in a mask. And there, I have personally friends who have kids of this age who are very concerned about their asthmatic children wearing a mask while competing at this level. It's a pretty intense level. This isn't like fourth grade Y volleyball. Does it concern you at all to think about asking these student athletes to play at that high competitive level while wearing a mask the entire time?
To be honest, I just don't think that's really practical. Exercising at that capacity, if you can move air back and forth through the mask set quickly enough that it's not going to impede your athletic performance. The question is, what's really the reliability of that mask in stopping the transmission of aerosolized viral particles or even secretions, for that matter? It's a really tough situation because I think all these kids want to go back. They want to play. They want to do things. But we're going to drive ourselves purely nutty because every time a kid tests positive on a team, every team member is going to be tested, every coach is going to be tested, and every time that happens all throughout the fall sports season, or winter for that matter too, it's going to be an ongoing battle to try and determine what do we do now. So it's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure really how that's practical. I understand why people would want to do it. Everyone's trying anything they can to try and slow the transmission of this down, but in a practical sense, it's going to be awfully difficult for kids. And I think it gives people a little bit of a false sense of security, too. I mean, you can imagine playing sports with a mask on and you're sweating. And, of course, all these masks lose their effectiveness when they get wet. And you're constantly touching your face. And you've just coughed into your mask. And now you've contaminated your hands. And you're touching other things. There comes that point where you think, how far do you take this? And is it really doing the good that it was thought to do to begin with?
I have like 10 seconds left here. But if you, like, what is the, if you have COVID-19, how long are you contagious?
Well, initially, I had said that you can shed virus out to 30 to 45 days or so afterwards, but that doesn't necessarily imply that that's an active virus that could infect you. So most of the facilities, healthcare places, if you've had a fever and are no longer febrile for about 72 hours or so, you can return to work with a mask on. So if you're no longer have symptoms, usually 3 to 5 days, maybe 7 days after that, the risk of transmitting that to someone else is awfully low at that point.
All right, Dr. Scott Hardeman, I want everyone to go check out urgentspecialist.com. It's the best in urgent care in the St. Louis metro area. Go check it out. And if you need an ENT, you might be able to see him because they have specialists there ready to go. Great to talk to you again, as always, and always the good straight-up information. People appreciate it so much.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much. If you missed part of this conversation, we will be posting it shortly, and you can go back and listen to all the questions, the coronavirus questions that were posed by you, the listener, and the ones that Ryan and I had as well. You can do that by listening to us on radio.com. You can hit the rewind feature, and you can just wait, and Katie will post it at 971talk.com/Annie, and also she'll share it to the Facebook page. Quick break. When we come back, Stephen Moore is going to join us, and I'm going to talk to Thomas DeVore, that attorney, the one who sued the governor on behalf of Darren Bailey. Now he's taking on the IHSA, and you're going to want to be around for that at 125. Don't go anywhere. Back in a minute.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.